Dreaming about being a big star. They say you're basic, they say you're easy. You're always riding in the backseat. Now I'm smiling from the stage while you were clapping.
Chapter 3. All told, it's a relief to get greenlit for outings again, based on whatever inscrutable calendar algorithms the comms director is running from a distance. Ed fucks off to Derrybrin for a week on a job doing floodplain excavation, more or less out of self-defense. And when he comes back, the comms director apparently decides Mustang better pony in public quick before Ed skips the country entirely. They return to the original agreement, and Ed starts being fed outdoors. The problem is, dating Mustang is actually pretty fun. If Ed doesn't think about it, what's actually happening is a hot guy with a shitload of money is showing him around town. He and Al have got cash, sure, but Mustang's another order up and knows what to spend it on. Not fancy clothes and jewelry like May, but stuff like taking Ed up to chug cocktails and throw pennies off the roof lounge in the spire, or getting a card room on the top deck of one of the big Rios casino barges, and whining about how Ed's a cheat while waiters bring them a steady stream of clams and grilled langoustines as the boat does the sunset loop around Central. Ed stopped even thinking about deciding where they eat by the third place, because it's become increasingly clear Mustang really knows the city, and if nothing else, the bastard follows through on his promises. He's also either dicked every maitre d' so good they're all bewitched into regurgitating a lifetime supply of VIP service, or else every waitstaff has a roster of politician headshots in the break room so they can identify bigwigs on sight, because they never wait for anything. They walk in, a girl zooms up on either side to offer up everything short of a blowjob, and the hostess presumably hits some kind of hidden button that alerts the kitchen staff to do a couple lines of coke and tase the chef with a cattle prod to fire out the dishes minutes after they've ordered them. Ed is aware it's kind of sad that he's impressed by this, but it gets him food immediately. Good food. Interesting food. White chocolate sticks, truffled beef slices, hummus and sour flatbread, olives and red pepper paste, vinegar oil and goat cheese. And that's just the appetizers. There might not be decent zhingis anywhere in the city, a fact that Ed is increasingly becoming aware is less an objective statement and more of a subjective experience due to his points of reference being Ling's personal imperial chefs. But there's plenty of other stuff. Date kitchens and kma and shak from the west. Southern lamb shashlik. And not the street stuff either. Fish roe and sour cream and beef pilaf from north. Molinige injera and lentils. Cayenne pomegranates and dried peach slices. Ed should probably also be more bothered by how right it feels to walk in somewhere and have everybody in the room drop what they're doing to reorient around his presence, especially since it's Mustang's presence that's the lodestone here, not Ed's. But fuck it, it's good. He gets free stuff everywhere now. Mustang takes Ed down into the National Trust's Art and Alchemy Private Historical Archives, and they let him eat down there. They were the ones offering him food in there. They let him hold a drink while touching the books. At Mustang's side, all Ed has to do is turn around for some guy to offer him a glass of tea, wine, whiskey, a cup of sliced watermelon cubes, a selection of Parmesan and tomato confit crunches, and nectarine and goat cheese crispies. Does Sir prefer white or red? Would the gentleman care for a snack? Boy, would he. And it's weird, interesting places they sit down to eat in, too. In one restaurant, their table's not really a table at all, just a massive hunk of sandstone, so curved and twisted it looks blown by the wind. At another, they eat on a single curved sofa in a refurbished conservatory. Big, bright, embroidered hangings practically glowing where they catch the sun. Ed can't deny it's better in this heat than knocking elbows and fighting over one communal saucepot with 30 sweaty dock workers in a riverside basement. But it's not like that's gonna stop him giving Mustang grief about it. Golly sheesh, a whole fountain? He says under his breath as they enter the latest place. A courtyard orange grove around a life-size sculpture of the Seven Jinn. Water burbling cheerfully from every available orifice. You want I should go wash my hands in there? Maybe spit and gargle? Mustang's mouth presses together in the way where he's trying not to laugh. My treasure, be sensible, he says, putting a hand to Ed's back as they weave through the thicket. At a place like this, they bring the pig trough straight to your table. His hand doesn't linger, slipping off Ed's waist as he draws out a chair. Mustang's touches are all like that, small but strategic, a visual signal meant to communicate intimacy without overmuch infringing on each other's personal space. It's a neat series of gestures, professionally executed, that make Ed marvel at how you can make people assume so much with so little. It's just practical, Ed tells himself. Like, this is just the bougie equivalent of covering each other around during a fight. Like when they'd shove each other up out of the way during Gluttony's rampage in the woods. And then they'll be in some restaurant and Ed will realize that Mustang's laid his arm out over the back of Ed's seat so that when he sits back, Mustang's hand is right there, slipping under his hair, so casually that Ed's brain just wholly blanks out for a second. It's not because it's the hair. Okay, it's a little bit the hair. Having it handled is always strange, because right when it got long, Ed didn't have an arm to do it with himself. If he wanted it put back properly, he had to rely on Granny or Winry or Al to fix it for him. But it also means he has people who just do that for him. Just see that he needed something and give it to him. He never had to ask. It's an odd feeling that got pre-programmed as a result, helpless and warm at the same time. So it's a weird, jarring unpleasantness when a stranger does it. And now? Mustang's palm is cool on the back of his neck. He's wearing a watch, the very edge of it heavy and solid against Ed's nape. He doesn't keep it there long, hardly 10 seconds. And even though Ed's brain cells feel like they're pooling in his sinuses, he's extremely aware of the mechanical nature of the touch. Mustang's not squeezing. He's not rubbing his thumb. He's just placing his hand in a way that communicates a specific external signal. He's not touching Ed. Their bodies just happen to be in contact. And yet, Ed's aware that he hasn't actually done a lot of dating, per se. With the university kids, it's usually just going to some party or bar surrounded by other people. And it's not like he actually dates most of the people he sleeps with. He and Winry had gone to places and done stuff together, but it wasn't ever... Nobody was trying to seduce anybody. Like, sure, Win put her arm around him and stuff. But it wasn't this. It wasn't Mustang grinning at him from across the table, cajoling him into trying raw oyster for the first time. The only time anyone ever focuses all their attention on Ed like this is during sex or in a fight. It makes him want to take his shirt off or break a plate over Mustang's head, and it is not good for his concentration. It's only ever for show. Ed should have known there were people in the house that day with the communications director, because Mustang doesn't really touch him in private. Not that they're in private often anymore. In the backs of cabs and elevators and the halls between rooms is all there is. For the best, really, because Ed's no longer sure he'd be able to stop himself from shaking Mustang by the collar and demanding something, at the very least an answer. This kind of circular, But what does he mean? Overthinking feels unpleasantly foreign, invasive, destabilizing what should have been steady all this time. He doesn't like trying to guess what the hell Mustang is getting at, playing games where he always just leveled with Ed before, threatening or demanding or punching. Nice, straightforward communication. But now Mustang thinks he needs to deal with him like this, and Ed feels like one of the 17-year-olds at McKenna's parties, plaintively asking, "But what does my boyfriend really mean?" It fucking sucks. At least when he was younger, whenever he was going through some shit, there wasn't time to get all wound up about it before it got superseded by even newer, bigger shit. Is it fucked up to miss that? Besides, he should be able to enjoy it. It feels good when people touch him, when they're interested. It shouldn't matter that it's Mustang. Or rather, it should matter and make him stop feeling like this. But all Ed's body knows is that someone who smells nice keeps touching him and talking to him in a nice voice, and he keeps having to make himself drop it, shake the thoughts out from between his own teeth to keep from just chewing and chewing and chewing. It maybe wouldn't be so bad if Mustang wasn't now noticing Ed all the time in return, or more specifically, his outfits, and very clearly enjoying them. Even if it's purely as one big inside joke. "I can't help it," Mustang protests after Ed glares at him over the latest shameless perusal of Ed's new pants. "It's like someone painted daisies on a landmine. You know how hard it is to make a crocodile look cuddly." It shouldn't feel like a compliment, especially since Ed learned pretty early on that he's got to go out of his way to not look cute if he wants to be treated as anything other than some kind of developmentally incapacitated garden gnome. He's relearning it all over again in these summer outfits, which, okay, yeah, are definitely more comfortable than black leather, but at the cost of making him look like an anthropomorphized basket of muffins. And while it is funny to see people's expressions change 5 to 50 seconds into actually talking to him, the whole point of this farce is that he is supposed to act like a whole basket of muffins, which is not actually flattering, even when people obviously think he's hot. He's well aware of what he looks like, pug nose and all, but his looks have always been in the back seat when it comes to whether people want him. He's short, he's unsettling, he's got the temper of a jackal. It's not what you've got, it's what you do with it. Hell, Al's the objective, physically upgraded version of him, and he doesn't get half the attention Ed does, purely because he's not pulling for it. And he could if he wanted to, the way he used to turn the 7 feet of battle armor, just a kid in a suit thing, on and off. And Ed likes when people look at him, look again, lean into him, smile. But right now, it's the smile people give little children holding their first arts and crafts project. And then there's Mustang's outfits. Mustang probably thinks he looks dashing or some shit, but in the uniform, he mostly just looks boxy and managerial. And while the dress uniform is more tailored, it's got so many layers and the kaftan doesn't hit above his knees, so the overall effect is different. But now they're going out all the damn time, and instead of his faceless white shirts, Mustang is dressing like Ed always, in his worst imaginances, suspected he would. The pants are tailored, the sleeves are rolled. If this were winter, he'd at least be all buttoned up, but it's June, and Mustang's collarbones are glaring at Ed like they want him to dump the nearest drink on them. Being proven right is a terrible thing. They start going to fewer restaurants and more eventy things, too, which means Ed can't just cope by focusing on the food. "The cornucopia is doing private showings of Merchant of Kessel," Mustang tells Ed the next afternoon when he picks him up. Ed removes his eyes from Mustang's wrist on the steering wheel, where today's watch looks like he pried it out of a catastrophic collision between a steel foundry and a radar station. The who is what? Mustang glances at Ed in vague consternation, opens his mouth, and visibly recalibrates. Grumman's very fond of theater. The cornucopia was remodeled largely due to his contribution, which prompted a bit of a boom. Garden plays are very popular right now. We're going to see one. Oh, Ed says. Theater's like movies, only the people are a lot harder to see, and it's pretty much impossible to include horseback stunts. Can we at least eat first?
There'll be food,
Mustang says unconcernedly, by which he means there's an open bar and a smattering of waiters lurking amongst a bunch of outdoor couch things spread around outside, because garden plays turn out to be pretty literal. Ed barely manages to hit up all the different trays, grumbling, before they all have to sit around and watch the performance. Or at least most people watch the play. Unfortunately for everyone, what Ed ends up mostly watching is Mustang's dick. It's not Ed's fault. Mustang sits relaxed, knees apart, one arm out along the back of the sofa thing behind Ed's head. This puts Ed in the position of sort of de facto snuggling into his armpit, only with approximately 3% area total body contact, and both Ed's shoulder and hair between their faces. At first, Ed has his little hors d'oeuvres, but when those run out, this conveniently, uninterruptedly, and upsettingly lets him zone in directly on Mustang's crotch. Ed automatically looks away like a nun catching a glimpse of ankle, gets mad at himself, makes himself glare back down. Why shouldn't he look? Wasn't his whole plan to go and desensitize himself anyway, before Mustang himself served his own ass up on a platter? For fuck's sake, it's not some kind of tasseled penis pouch. It's just pants. Gray linen. One of those fancy panel dealios that make it seem like there's barely any fly at all. All of Mustang's civilian stuff is aggressively tailored, so it's not like there's even an outline or anything. But there's definitely a bulge. It's a fairly indistinct bulge, however. This is extremely unhelpful. Well, whatever. It's probably a terrible dick anyway, even if it doesn't seem like it would be. Mustang's like the least stinkiest guy Ed's ever met, and rich as shit besides. He probably takes care of his dick in ways that aren't even accessible to the general public. That dick probably gets whatever the five-star spa treatment of dicks is on a bi-weekly basis. It's probably insultingly decent. Except for all the messed up shit he's into. Ed glares at the silent crooks of Mustang's inseam. Give up your secrets, he wills it, with all the latent psychic ability he may possess. But it refuses to develop sentience, telepathy, or any desire to communicate. Some guy on stage says a line to general laughter. Ha ha ha, Ed supplies dutifully, not breaking his stare down. Even though he probably should. It sounds like a fun show. And this is just stupid. The last time he spent this much time thinking about a penis, it was attached to Greedling. And Mustang's doesn't even have the ability to change elemental composition mid-erection. The time before that, Ed was trying to figure out if he should have one. The whole being a man thing was, for him, always kind of an internal loop-de-loop track. A slaloming course set more often than not by factors outside of his control. It's only from the outside that it looks like a straight shot, a linear progression of societal presence and hormones and surgery. He's met enough others like him that he knows he's not an outlier there, even if, since he lived with surgeons, the medical conversations had more in common with some guy at a party offering you a new drug than anything else. Hey man, wanna try some of this? Granny already had him on the table for his fourth post-automail shoulder surgery when she asked if he wanted what remained of his tits off. While I'm at it, she'd offered, handing him the anesthesia mask. seeing as I'm going to be in there anyway. Ed's response had pretty much amounted to a double thumbs up and fuck yeah. No breast tissue jolting around when he ran. No menstruation to knock him on his ass 1 week in four. The decisions were no-brainers. And gender might have started for him before he knew what it was, but it's not like he was trapped in a dress, staring out at men and going, me. For pretty much as long as he can remember, boy wasn't the important word so much as alchemist. And until teacher, the only alchemist he knew was his father. But not all men are like that. Sure, by and large, they all tend towards the shabby and unreliable, but the exceptions outshine the mediocrity of the aggregate. Uncle Yuri, Sig, Al, Greed, Ling, Darius, Henkel, Mustang. Mustang isn't like Sig or Uncle Yuri. He isn't like Colonel Hughes. He wears the uniform like the concept of a military is a painted set backdrop commissioned for his convenience. He uses his looks like a battering ram, moves like a spoiled heiress, except for when he's closing in like a grudge. He's not just a tenant in his body, like his soul happened to land there. He controls it like Granny controls a scalpel. Mustang is a man on purpose. Sure, he sold himself to be a state dog, which everyone said was awful, but he seemed to do whatever he liked, whenever he felt like it. He's an alchemist. He smells good. For a while there, Ed had managed to convince himself it's not that he wanted Mustang, he just wanted to be him. And then he learned more about what happened in Ishval, which took away that rationale pretty permanently. Not that searching externally ever answered this kind of question anyway. Not that Ed was much in a position to be looking. It's not that he didn't want to be a girl. It's just that he isn't one. And he doesn't want to be like Mustang. He just wants him. It's not worse. It's not a long play. It can't be more than 30 minutes before the actors line up and bow, and the final laughing applause dissipates into chattering discussion, glasses beginning to clink as people gravitate back to the bar. "Get us a drink," Mustang says idly as they stand, eyes already on a cluster of men with expensive-looking wives across the grass, and Ed would tell him to remember which one of them is supposed to be the pampered pet here. Only he probably really should go take himself elsewhere before he starts using actual math to try and estimate the volumetric dimensions of Mustang's dick. "What did you think?" Ed turns. There's a lady with big, chunky earrings and white streaks in her hair grinning at him, a glass in hand whose alcohol content he can smell from here. He vaguely recognizes her as having been on one of the couches nearby. "Think of what?" "The play," she says, her grin starting to sparkle. "Oh, yeah, it was nice," Ed says warily. He does not trust the sparkle. This lady might look like someone's dream charm-selling vodka granny, but she feels like she ought to have a hook for a hand and a parrot on one shoulder. "Very nice. And if I asked you the lead's name right now, you'd say Roy Mustang, hmm?" "What?" The lady cackles at whatever face Ed's making. "You were a bit focused on a slightly different stage there." She gives him a patronizing squeeze of bicep before he can dredge up some half-hearted denial. "You just go and get your money's worth, young man." "Ha!" "Well, at least even the randy old ladies think he's a gold digger," Ed thinks sourly as he makes his escape. Is this why Mustang pulled him into this? Because Ed's crush means he can sell the ruse without even trying? Why rely on someone's acting skills when you can just have the real deal, right? Plus, of course, the whole being able to handle himself thing. Ed gets his first tale 2 days later. He's trawling every damn market in Windside and Lower Third, trying to find at least one place that sells gray pepper and powdered shrimp. And the guy two stalls down, pretending to inspect some onions, has been with him the whole way. It's even the same dude a day later when Ed shows up to work at a CEC site. They're undergrounding for the city grid today, all the way down the hill and across the river. So there's 6 work crews and 5 other alchemists, all setting up their sections all down the scrubby greenbelt running alongside the east side rail yard tracks. The guy is loitering around the gap between lots where the freight crews take smoke breaks, cap pulled low and newspaper up in front of his face. Ed wedges his fingers under the rim of his hard hat and scratches his sweaty hair, sitting back on his haunches over his chalk array. Rawl, who he slept with for a couple of weeks last spring, is a cargo foreman at this depot, and Ed's pretty sure he still works here. So if he goes over and finds him and says there's a weird guy following him around, then he won't even have to lift a finger to get the dude cleared out. That's a highly localized and short-term solution, however. Ed flips the chalk in his hand, looking around, then smiles. "Hey, Branson," he calls, extra sweet. "Could you come over here a minute?" Branson comes over, wary, tucking his clipboard under his arm. "What is it?" Ed blinks up at him, big-eyed. "Does this look right to you?" Branson stares at Ed, then stares at the array, then back at Ed, then once again at the array, like it's about to hatch a giant spider. "Yes? Can you sit down just a second and tell me how you would do it?" Branson is now staring like he expects the spiders to come pouring out of Ed's mouth. "Come on," Ed says, widening his eyes even bigger, sweeter, letting Branson know that if he tries to run, he won't get 2 steps. "Please?" Branson slowly crouches down next to Ed like a man standling himself into a noose. "Look, Elric." "Shush," Ed says, handing him the chalk. "Just run it through like I'm one of the apprentices. I know you know how." He bats his eyes twice. "Don't you want to do me a favor?" "Why?" Branson says bleakly. "I just want to make sure I did it right." "You think the right way is whichever way you did it." "And am I wrong?" Branson gives him a look of equal parts hopelessness and aggravation as he takes the chalk. Ed scoots closer to his side, like he really does need to see what Branson's doing to his math, giving him a friendly bump to the shoulder. "Aw, cheer up. There's worse shit to be auditing on a Tuesday morning." "You seriously want me to explain a ditch-digging array to you?" Branson says, kind of blankly. "Your own array. It's... you never even put any scripts down." "Gosh, sounds like something you should address with me then," Ed says earnestly, all but cuddling up to Branson's side. "After all, you are my boss." Branson looks appropriately upset by this concept, enough to start mechanically explaining the rote principles of dirt and clay manipulation, his eyes on the ground as he methodically scrapes out each step in chalk. "Good," Ed says when he's done. "Assign me to all your work sites going forward." "What?" "You heard me." Ed tips forward onto his knees, using the momentum to throw an arm around Branson's shoulder and neck. "Thank you so much for helping." Branson goes rigid like a possum playing dead, which is commendable if misguided. He really should know it doesn't work on the smart predators. "Now," Ed says much more quietly in his ear, gripping in a friendly way, "you're gonna start bitching." Branson looks bewildered, or at least as much as he can, when he's staring dead ahead with his face frozen. "What?" "Nothing creative. You're sick of it. You don't want to put up with it anymore. You've kept your mouth shut about getting saddled with some dumbass Nepo bimbo and doing a double share of work on top of yours, not to mention catching all the fuck-ups before he can blow us all up to kingdom come. But it's not like you can get rid of him." "Who?" Branson says, desperate. "Me," Ed says patiently. "Duh, As far as you're concerned, I don't know a Cynic from a cinnamon stick, understand? You got stuck with me because your boss told you it'd be a great career move to show me a few ropes and tell me what a great job I'm doing when I draw a circle like a big boy all by myself. Especially if anyone military comes asking. Get me? Branson nods, hypnotized. Hooray! Ed squeezes his neck in a hug. You're so nice to me. You won't regret helping me out. Branson staggers away, clearly thinking this is some kind of possibly hallucinatory anomaly he can work his way out of. But Ed shadows him for the rest of the day, asking increasingly dumb questions in an increasingly pathetic voice. Branson gives up on being frazzled pretty quick, at least, and starts doing a great job, sounding convincingly dull and annoyed. None of the other alchemists here have ever met Ed before. They're all new, all juniors, because ditch digging really is kiddie shit, and Ed only got assigned here because he can blow through 6 miles of cable path before all five of them can do three, and they need somebody to do the wire sheathing under the river at the end. He takes care of that at the end of the day with Branson, the two of them making their way through the tunnel they'll close behind them, alchemizing the sealant and triple-checking all the access points section by section. For this, they're repeating the same array over and over, ditching the chalk in favor of inking the sealant array into their hands. Ed made Branson be the one to draw it on him, blinking haplessly up at him, while very much enjoying the sidelong glances of the newbie alchemists and the rigidly controlled look on Branson's face as he set the marker to Ed's palm. The look dissolved into real unhappiness the minute the two of them went down into the tunnel, but Ed's more interested in vaguely poking through the math of whether he could theoretically set up some kind of cascading chain reaction that'd catalyze all the sections for them in one go. When they're almost at the end, though, Branson asks, under his breath, "Are you in trouble?" Is Branson worried about him? Ed turns to him, interested. "What would you do if I were?" Branson watches him right back, sidelong. "Depends on what kind," he finally says, sounding unhappy about it. Ed grins. "Smart." He presses his palm to the last unfixed joint and lets the light blaze blue, sealing the last chunk of pipe. "I am in trouble, Branson. Don't you worry. All you gotta do is tell the truth. You're sick of working with me, and I'm a huge pain in your ass." Branson doesn't look any happier. "If the military wants you to, look, the state alchemist program's not that bad, especially now since... But if they're pressuring you..." Ed's cackle is maybe a little too loud, cutting Branson off into an even more guarded expression. "Pressuring me!" "Your brother left for Jing," Branson says a little defiantly. "He didn't say when he'd be coming back." Ed rolls his eyes, deciding not to mention that's more because Ed filed the paperwork wrong than anything. "January. Al's fine, and I am too, okay? And we'll stay fine, so long as you keep your mouth shut. Or rather, don't." He gives Branson a smirk. "Come on, don't tell me it won't be at least a little satisfying to shit-talk me in the break room." Branson doesn't exactly look soothed and healed by these confidences, but Ed leaves work with a spring in his step. This scheming shit is familiar, reminding him that this whole thing with Mustang is just another plot, and a fight he has to keep up in, too. His brain feels a little bit like a hibernating salamander put in sunlight, waking after a long time stiff. He's not trapped in a slowly constricting bubble with himself and his thoughts about Mustang's stupid dick. He's doing a job he's good at, a game he can win. He can make it through this fine.